And, you know, there's a famous quote of, you know, how Jesus was a liar, lunatic. He was either, you know, a madman, the devil, or he was who he said he was. And when it comes to the person of Jesus, the historical person of Jesus, where do we stand from a, you know, from a scientific point of view in the accuracy that there was a man 30 years old walking around in the Middle East doing what we read about in the Bible today?
Yeah. Well,
to big question, I know.
It is. I mean, but to wind back, you know, why do we need Jesus, not just God? It's as simple as anyone can work out that there's a God.
Welcome to This Is Us podcast. I'm your host, Thomas Hansen, and my wife and I have the honor of serving alongside an amazing team as lead pastors of Hillsong Church in Denmark and Malmö. This podcast is a collection of short episodes regarding life, leadership, and culture. If you haven't done so already, please click follow and subscribe. And as always, if you find this to be valuable, feel free to share it with others. Well, we are here with John Dixon. Welcome to This Is Us podcast.
Thanks, mate. Good to
and,
be with you.
And you are a podcaster yourself. That has been a new development on Deception.
It's been very surprising to me.
That's amazing.
So, you know, 3 years ago, a bunch of people said, oh, you really should do a podcast. And I said, oh, it's everyone's doing podcasts, right? It's so, you know, 2015.
Right.
But they convinced me. And I did it, and it's become a big part of my life now. I spend a lot of my time now just doing the podcast.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's why you're in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm interviewing a bunch of scholars who aren't Christians but are experts in Viking history and in the conversion of the Vikings to Christianity, which is a story very few people understand. It's a story the Netflix series does not explore.
They missed that episode.
Yeah, because it's not as cool, right? It's far cooler to have all these pagan ceremonies of sacrificing animals and people and then going out and fighting battles and raping and pillaging. And that cliche resonates with people, and it's exciting and it's adventure. But all that boring stuff about, you know, the God who loved us and gave himself
loving your neighbor
us and caring for the poor and blah, 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 right? It's not going to make a good Netflix series.
Right.
But often when I'm watching that series, I turn to my wife, Buff, and I say, you know, as cool as this is to watch, no way would you want to live in this society.
Right.
You would want to live in the boring, caring for the poor Christian society.
Right.
You would choose to live in that reality, even though we choose to watch this Netflix reality.
Wow. Isn't that amazing? I mean,
we don't know what we have.
No, exactly.
In the Christian faith.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that's coming out more and more. I mean, I've seen, you know, couple therapists and sexologists and, you know, just talking about, in Danish you say salsa kartofler. You just need the mundane, that there is power in the mundane of just loyalty, faithfulness, just showing up.
Yeah.
But that's not the movies. The movies is Sex and the City. It's the out there, you know, sowing your oats and all that stuff, but really the power and the value is in the mundane.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's about relationships that function really well.
Right.
We are social animals.
Yeah.
And we long for really good relationships. And over the last 10 years, you can see a huge decline in the number of close friends that human beings, that individuals in the West have.
Mm.
So 10 to 15 years ago, I can't remember the exact numbers, although I did just do a podcast on it. You could ask people how many close friends you have, and they would say something like 12.
Mm.
Now it's more like 3.
Wow.
So it's a really steep decline. And of course, if meaning is found in relationships, in knowing and being known, loving and being loved, and we're not pursuing that, then of course we're going to struggle with depression and anxiety and so on.
Mm.
And of course, I'd add that we're made for relationship with God.
Yeah.
And in fact, the reason we're so relational as creatures is because God himself is Father, Son, and Spirit.
Mm.
He is a relationship. He is one God, but he is in a love relationship between the Father, Son, and the Spirit. And so all of our relationships are like the reflection of that. You know, to ponder that the thing at the heart of the universe, even before there was a creation, was a love relationship.
It's amazing.
And so when we are in good love relationships, we are touching the heartbeat of the universe.
Wow. But I mean, when you look at Netflix, Vikings, you also see, man, how far the gospel brought people. You know, that we came from that, mm-hmm. I mean, utter darkness mm-hmm. to, you know, what Christianity actually is.
Yep.
And that journey of what they encountered. Now, we're not going to give you to make any spoilers of your own podcast that's coming up, but I am looking forward to listening to that. But when it comes to the gospel, you are not only a podcaster, you're actually a songwriter as well. Do you want to just give us a little brief?
Not really.
No? Do you want to give us a brief?
I used to do it a lot, but when I'm in Hillsong company, I don't bother ever talking about my music.
Okay. But you have had a huge influence on Hillsong music.
Not really. I just suggested they write that song about the Apostles' Creed.
Yeah.
This, I believe. And they did, yes.
And it's been a blessing to millions of people.
Oh, hasn't it? And, yeah. And brought people a new awareness of the Apostles' Creed, because we forget that these 83 words in the original language of the Apostles' Creed are like the summary of what we all share.
Yeah.
We all share this belief. And so for all our differences, right, and I'm a boring Anglican, okay? So,
right.
So, you know, there are many differences between Hillsong and Anglicanism.
A few.
But our Apostles' Creed is our shared statement of faith, the 83 words all Christians agree on. I love it.
Yeah.
And the fact that you guys put that into a cracking song, is cracking a word they use here?
It is now.
Okay.
It is now.
That means very good.
Yes.
Or something like that. Is a gift to the world.
Yeah, it
so
is.
So well done you.
Well done, team. Well done, team out there.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Ben and Matt, who wrote that, just awesome.
Yeah, they are. But you're also an author, mm-hmm. and you've authored several. How many books have you authored?
It's a little bit embarrassing.
Why?
A few years ago, it was 20, and I'm not sure.
Have you pulled some off the market? Or
No. I mean.
I don't believe that anymore.
I've written, I can't remember how many exactly.
Okay.
So it's more than 20.
Wow.
Okay, it's 22, 23, something like that.
Amazing. And one of the topics, or what's really part of your mandate, is the whole area of apologetics, explaining faith to skeptics, to people that don't believe. Before we dive into that, could you tell me why is that an area that interests you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a bit nervous about the word apologetics nowadays. I understand why you use it, but for me, sometimes the word apologetics just means trying to use any argument, even bad arguments, to promote Christianity. I know that's not what you mean, but sometimes that's the impression people have of it.
Right.
So I just want to be doing good scholarship in service of the promotion of Jesus Christ in public. But to answer your question, look, I think it's as simple as people have questions about the faith.
Mm.
And so, of course, we have to answer the faith. And the word apologia in Greek, from which we get apologetics, just means give an answer, right? Mm. It just means an answer, a defense.
Yeah.
And it actually appears in 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to give an apologia, an apologetic, an answer to everyone who asks you for the reason, logos, the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, Peter says. And so it's that goal of giving a reasoned answer to people's questions with gentleness and respect that drives, you know, much of what I do.
And it's great to hear that reason and faith are not opposing values.
Oh, well, they can't be. And they never were in the history of Christianity.
Right.
This is one of the best kept secrets of the modern world. The early Christians, like in the 200s, 300s, 400s, They were super nerds.
Right.
Right? As well as faithful and willing to be thrown to the lions for the faith. Did you know?
Probably not.
In the year 200, just to be considered a member of the church, you had to do 140 hours of schooling in the Christian faith.
Whoa.
And this is still a period where the church is being persecuted, where it's made up of slaves and uneducated women. And so it's not the highbrow church of, you know, the 5th century. This is the year 200. They just knew the world was so pagan, was so opposed to the Christian faith, that the only way to embed people in the faith in a strong way was to school them in the faith in a profoundly deep way, learning the Old Testament and the New Testament, learning the creeds, learning how to answer. So we have some of the material, the school material from the year 200.
Wow.
Learning how to answer pagan Greeks, Jews who don't believe, Samaritans, and so on. And why was I telling you this? Oh, because they never saw any difference or any contradiction between using your brain,
right,
and just trusting Jesus Christ with everything you've got.
That's beautiful.
It's only a modern construct that has separated those two things.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, these days we're in the middle of obviously a global pandemic, and the argument between science and faith is sickening. Because some people are drawing up these battle lines that never supposed to be there. And at the same time, you have such a rich history of churches and the Christian community leading the way in science and in medicine and in all the different fields of science, that it must be for you that have a greater insight into that. It must be such a frustrating thing to watch.
It is terrible. We forget that the very first scientists of the modern period, you know, the scientific revolution, Newton, Boyle, Kepler, even Galileo, about which much nonsense is written. But anyway, all these early scientists thought that they were doing worship.
Wow.
And they explicitly say so in their writings, right? It isn't just that everyone went to church in those days. That is also rubbish. It's that they actually thought, we have God's book, the Bible, but we also have God's world, where God's wisdom is imprinted on the world. And so when you see the regularities of the sun and the stars, you're seeing the wisdom of God. When you are testing responses to medicines in the body and you realize that there are regularities in the body, that there are laws, scientific laws that govern everything, you're seeing the mind of God imprinted in the world. Now, that is the attitude of the very first scientists who gave us this thing that we love so much called science. And it's just a tragedy that in very recent times, people have begun to think there's a contradiction between science and faith. And there mustn't be. Science is discovering God's wisdom in stuff, in the creation.
Wow.
And I've just on this trip interviewed some top scientists from MIT, one of the greatest scientific university in the world, for example, believing Christians who say there's no contradiction between faith and science. They're doing different things.
Of course.
I mean, science can't tell me how I should love my neighbor. Science can't tell me that I should care for the poor and the weak.
Right.
But science can tell me that there's an orderliness in the world. And they would say, and one of them in particular, who's a professor of artificial intelligence at MIT, she made the point that people often say the more science discovers, the less God there can be, right? Because we now can explain stuff. But she said it's exactly the opposite.
Wow.
Because the more you realize about the universe and how it functions, the more mathematical it appears, the more rational it appears, the more logical it appears, and therefore the more you're seeing the work of God.
The design.
The design of the universe.
Wow.
In the creation itself. So it's the opposite of the more we discover, the less God there is. The more we discover, the more you see the mind of God, which is actually exactly what the early scientists thought.
I mean, it's I got three daughters, and my youngest one, she's 7, and she said the other day, she goes, "Daddy, if God has made everything, that means when I go and touch the grass out in the backyard, I've touched the things that God has touched."
Oh, what a beautiful thing.
And I'm like,
that's true.
Like, yeah. It's so, you know, but that's what
you see,
science
everything
does.
Everything becomes worship then.
Yeah, you discover God in nature without, you know, deifying nature.
Well, we mustn't.
No.
We mustn't. And And that's the thing. I mean, science should push us beyond nature, because what we discover in nature is this mathematical elegance that points beyond itself.
The fingerprints.
Yeah. And so we think, oh my goodness, we've discovered this new law of how something works. We should go, the lawgiver. How awesome must the lawgiver be?
Wow. I love
that. Instead of how awesome is the stuff that obeys the laws.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Dumb. Why would you worship the stuff that's simply obeying the laws given by the lawgiver?
Yeah, right. That's amazing. What's your own journey of faith? Have you always been a believer?
No, I grew up in Sydney, classic Aussie household, lived by the beach, didn't think about God. Neither parent thought about God, went to church. And so I'd never been to a church service before I was 16.
Wow.
But like you'll know this, in Australia, they still have this weird throwback to earlier Christian times where it's a scripture lesson in high school where a volunteer from church can come and for half an hour, take the children and talk about the Christian faith. Or a Jewish rabbi can come and people can go and do a rabbi class.
I've done those classes.
Yeah.
I've been that volunteer that came in.
Okay, well, exactly, exactly. And so in year 9, when I was 15, I got a scripture teacher who was smart and funny. She was a middle-aged mum from down the road. And I asked all my smart aleck questions and tried to make her look stupid because it had worked with all the other scripture teachers.
Right.
Didn't work. She was smart and funny, had an answer to all my questions. And I thought, man, how does this Christian get the better of me every time? And so I started to listen. And I became really curious. And one day after class, I saw her in the hallway, and I made sure none of my friends could see me talking to this religious woman because I didn't want them to think I was going to catch it. And I said, excuse me, what do you think God thinks of me? If he's real, what do you think God thinks of me? And she said, oh, John, he sees everything you've done, said, and thought. And she left a pause. I remember thinking,
yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly.
And then she said, but he loves you even still. I thanked her. I shot off into the playground. And I thought, he sees everything I've done, said, and thought. And he loves me even still.
Wow.
Those two thoughts actually brought me over the next few days and weeks to the realization I was a sinner, to put it in, you know, Christian terms.
Yeah.
Because if he sees everything I've done, said, and thought, I mean, I know what a jerk I am.
Mm.
So he must know it even better. But he loves me? That's grace. So in that one reply from her, I got sin and grace. So a month or so later, she invited the whole class she was teaching to her home, which would now be illegal. Right? She sent to prison for it. Yeah. For hamburgers, milkshakes, and scones.
Good combo.
After school on Friday afternoons, because she lived 500 meters from school. So my mates and I turned up at her home one Friday afternoon, ate her food. And then she said, have you got questions? We asked her questions about the Christian faith, ate more food. And then she brought out the Bible. I was a little bit worried at that point, right, because I'd never read the Bible.
Right.
But what she did is she read the Gospels to us.
Wow.
You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, the biographies of Jesus. Brilliant strategy. She just started reading it. And then the next week, next Friday we came, she read a little bit more, a little bit more. And so we read all the Gospels. That was our introduction to the Christian faith, which is a great introduction, Jesus.
Right.
He's our best card.
Yeah.
Right? Some would say he's the only card we've got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's kind of a central figure in Christianity.
Indeed. And I found myself over the next months, I kept on going back with my mates to this woman's home for the next 6 months. By the end of that 6 months, I would have called myself more than a fan of Jesus. I was a follower.
Wow.
And I was so captivated by his power and humility. So you see his humility in caring for people, right? And even the sinners and outcasts of his day, he's so tender. And then you see him arguing with the religious elite, and he's powerful and a little bit scary.
Yeah.
Then you see him willing to die on a cross and take people's punches in the face and take the Roman soldiers' brutality. And then he's raised to life. So this humility, power is what really drew me to Jesus himself. And so I'd say at the end of 6 months, maybe a year of going to this woman's house, I was a genuine Christian. She was not very pushy with us. She just conveyed the love of Christ.
It's beautiful.
Powerfully. And five of us became Christians. Three of us from that one class are now pastors.
Wow.
Yeah. All from non-Christian homes. So she was incredible. And, you know, after we became Christians.
Did you stay in touch with her?
Yeah, yeah. And she died in 2017, but I kept in touch with her all the way through.
Wow.
In fact, I had the chance to take my children to her home on many occasions, and she would make hamburgers, milkshakes, and scones for us, just brilliant. As a joke. And, yeah, I was with her, you know, just days before she died. I ended up leading her funeral.
Wow.
It was very moving and powerful for me. And my last book on Jesus is dedicated to her because she introduced me to Jesus.
That's beautiful. I mean, the question of Jesus, that's where it all hinges on.
Yep.
I had a friend with me in church once, and afterwards I said, well, what do you think? And we're having dinner, and he's like, yeah, it was good. I was like, what? I was like, why so much Jesus? I mean, he's in marketing, so he's like, if you just expanded and said God, you would get more people through the door. And I'm like, yeah, but the door is Jesus. Yeah. That's the issue. And so it's not just God, because you get to define your own God if you just use the name God. Mm. And, you know, there's a famous quote of, you know, how Jesus was a liar, lunatic. He was either, you know, a madman, the devil, or he was who he said he was. And when it comes to the person of Jesus, the historical person of Jesus, where do we stand from a, you know, from a scientific point of view in the accuracy that there was a man 30 years old walking around in the Middle East doing what we read about in the Bible today?
Yeah. Well,
question, I know.
It is. I mean, but to wind back, you know, why do we need Jesus, not just God? It's as simple as anyone can work out that there's a God, right? Just rationally, I think anyone can work that out. You know, it's like when you see a film beautifully produced, you know there was a director, okay? When you see a beautiful home, you know there was an architect. But you can't know the architect. You can't know the director unless the architect one day turns up at your home, knocks on your door and says, hey, I'm the one who designed this house. Then you can invite the architect in for a cup of tea and get to know her, right?
Can I pause you for 1 second there? Do you think it's arrogance, or what do you think it is that makes us look at the beautiful designed world and say, there's no designer, that's all by chance?
Hmm. It's a little, well, I mean, if you can believe it's all by chance, I think that is a giant leap of faith.
Right.
Because we find rationality, orderly, elegant mathematics in everything from the outer cosmos to the tiniest particle. Okay. So if you can say all of that orderliness, which we know existed in the universe from the nanosecond after the Big Bang, if you can believe that that was just accidental, then all power to you, right?
Right.
But I would just say if you see the orderliness in everything, the most logical conclusion is that it represents an orderly mind. How could order come from nothingness? I mean, it's a larger question. How could anything come from nothing?
Right? Yeah.
But even leaving that aside, how could orderliness, mathematical elegance, which is in everything, right? And it's the same maths that works at the particle level that works at the cosmic level.
Crazy.
So there's a oneness to the universe as well. There's not just logic, it's one logic that works all the way in and all the way out. So this is why I'm saying it's absolutely logical to say there must be an architect,
right,
who designed the house. So God isn't like a little wardrobe hidden in the basement, right? Some people think of God like that. Like God is just like Thor, right? Or God is like, you know, Big Tooth, Bigfoot, right? Or God is like Santa.
Big Tooth.
I've got Harold Bluetooth on my mind, yeah, at the moment. So
look at that tooth.
I'm sure one of the Vikings was called Big Tooth.
I'm sure.
But it would be wrong to think of God like that, because God is not an object in the world. We don't believe in God because we find him hidden in the attic or in the basement. We know God's there because the windows work, because the doors work, the bloomin' hi-fi system works throughout the house.
Right.
Right? So there's orderliness in everything, and therefore there is one who's imposed the order. Right. But my point is, you can't possibly know anything about that mind unless the architect knocks on your door and says, hey, can we have a cup of tea? I've got a few things to tell you.
Right. Right.
And that brings us to Jesus. So my point is, anyone can work out that there is a God. But unless God has stepped into history, across that, you know, great barrier of eternity into history, where it's a guessing game.
Right.
Now, to your actual question.
Because why our God and not the other gods?
Yeah, but the other gods haven't stepped into history.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the thing is, Christianity really is historical. So it used to be the case, 60 to 100 years ago, to say, oh, the Gospels, they're not real historical writings. The New Testament was written hundreds of years later, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe Jesus lived, but, you know, who knows? Now, that is almost impossible to argue nowadays. I mean, there are a few fringies who are saying that. But the vast majority of scholars, even secular scholars, think that the Gospels are our best historical portraits of the figure of Jesus. And the reason they say this, this is an entire thing, and I teach a 26-hour course at Sydney University on the history of Jesus, but let me just put it this way. Historians work out all that we can know about the background of that time and place.
Right.
Okay. Archaeology, stuff that Tacitus wrote, stuff that Philo wrote, Josephus wrote, people from the time. You know, we work out everything we can know about politics and economy and geography and everything, right? And then the historian takes an individual figure. Could be Pontius Pilate, could be Emperor Tiberius, or let's just go with Jesus and say, let's read those sources and see if they read like they are from that time and place.
Right.
Does the individual figure fit the background? That's number one. And overwhelmingly, the Gospels fit the background of everything we know.
They paint the picture that we know.
Yeah, he fits in that scene. Okay, so that's step one. Step two is, how many different authors mention Jesus?
Right.
And we have secular authors who mention Jesus. There's a secular writer called Thallus. There's another one called Mara Bar Serapion. There's Josephus, there's Tacitus, Pliny. These are non-Christian writers from within the 100 years of Jesus, and they all refer to Jesus in passing, sometimes critical, sometimes neutral. But they tell us an awful lot of information. They actually tell us when and where he lived. They tell us he was a famous teacher. Two of them even tell us he was a renowned healer, even though the texts don't say what explains that.
Right.
So Josephus says he performed paradoxa erga, baffling deeds, right? Paradoxa meaning like paradoxical, weird deeds. It's his neutral way of saying, I don't know what they were, but you know, he did something.
Something right. Weird's going on with that guy.
And so, there are these non-Christian sources. But actually, the truth of the matter is, and I'm not just saying this in a Christian podcast. This is the sort of thing I teach at Sydney University, one of the greatest secular universities in Australia. And it's the sort of thing I could teach in any classics, ancient history department in the world. The best sources we have are actually the New Testament sources, because they're much closer in time and they are disparate sources. So although they appear in one book today, the New Testament, actually we know they were written separately from one another. So Mark wrote independently of Paul.
Right.
And Paul wrote independently of Mark. And then there's another source that Matthew and Luke had we call Q. There's another one that John had called SQ. And I won't bore your listeners with all the details. But in the secular scholarship, we think with a high degree of confidence there are at least five, maybe more, maybe seven, different sources that are now bundled together into the New Testament. And so when different sources say roughly the same thing about a person or an event,
Right.
Your degree of confidence about that person or event lifts, especially if those sources are written close in time to the events. And in the New Testament case, they are very close. And I often try to explain to people, think of Alexander the Great. Everyone knows he lived. Everyone thinks they know lots about what he did. He went and conquered the world and da da da, right, 300 years or so before Jesus. Now, our first biographical account of him is from 120 years after he's dead. It's Polybius, right? Crazy. Our best source for Alexander the Great is from 400 years after Alexander. It's called Arrian. Okay. 400 years, best source. 120, still, it's a closest source.
Yeah. Right?
Now, turn to Emperor Tiberius, who was the ruler, the emperor when Jesus lived. So it's a really good comparison. He dies in the year 37, so a few years after Jesus. Our very best source, in the opinion of every ancient historian, is Tacitus, who writes around the year 120. That's 80 years after Tacitus, after Tiberius. The very best source for the emperor. Now, New Testament. We know sources are written within 20 years. We have lots of sources within 50 years and all of our sources within 60 years.
Wow.
So all of the New Testament writings are closer in time to Jesus than the best source we have for the emperor of the same period. Now, this doesn't prove everything in the Gospels.
No.
But it is a reason to take the Gospels way more seriously than the average skeptic thinks. And for me, that is the role of what we call apologetics, or what I just call doing good history.
Yeah, yeah, right.
The goal isn't to prove Jesus. You know, I think I can make a very good argument that Jesus had a reputation as a healer. I think I can make a very good argument on historical grounds that there was an empty tomb and that people really thought they saw him. All of that, right? But the main role is not to convert people through argument. I think the main role of this sort of good historical argumentation is to say to people, look, there's every reason in the world for you to pick up a gospel and read it for yourself.
Yeah.
Because it's not like picking up The Lord of the Rings.
Even though that's a good pickup.
It's a great pickup. You're reading real history.
Right.
This is not about Middle Earth. This is about Middle East. Its sources written in the same century in which all the events took place. They've been preserved incredibly well, right? Better than any other source we know from the same period in terms of its copying. So pick it up, the Gospel of Luke, perhaps, and there you will find a living, breathing Jesus who leaps out of the page and very often grabs people and pulls them into his world and expands their world with this figure that I said a moment ago captured me,
yeah.
This one of humility and power.
Yeah, because it's not about, you know, it's about at the end of the day to go, well, there was a Jesus. The big question is, what will you do with him?
Yeah.
It's not about, it's not about denying whether Jesus, we know he was there. Mm-hmm. It's more, you've just got to figure out now, what do you want to do with this person called Jesus and what he said?
And that isn't just an intellectual thing.
No.
It's an emotional thing. It's a thing of experience. You know, Aristotle, just to go nerdy in Greek philosophy with you for a sec, Aristotle, 300 and so years before Jesus, said that there are three parts to persuasion, three parts to convincing us of things. And I think he was absolutely right. Logos, the intellectual dimension. We want evidence. Pathos, the emotional dimension, the beauty dimension. We're drawn to those things that are attractive. Okay. And then he said the most important is ethos, the integrity, character, quality, moral quality of a thing. Right. And I think all of those factors play in whether people disbelieve or believe. Logos, intellectual. They may have seen some skeptical documentary on Danish television that they tucked away in their head and said, oh, there's no evidence for the Bible. Tiny little bit of logos. But then the pathos, right? Maybe they aren't attracted to those church buildings, right? There was no beauty in that Lutheran service they once went to.
Right.
Okay. Ethos, the character, they may have been hurt by a Christian in the past and they think Christians are jerks. Okay. The thing a skeptic needs to realize is their unbelief is as influenced by those three factors as any Christian's belief. And what often happens is when Christians believe, it's logos, pathos, ethos. They hear or read a good argument. Yeah. They think, oh, maybe there's something in it. Then they pick up a gospel and they read it and they go, the beauty of this, the teaching of Jesus, if only this were true. Oh, my goodness, grace, love, his death for us. Oh, I wish. And then ethos, they bump into a community of Christians who actually look like Christians. They're not jerks. They're caring for the vulnerable. They're making easy friendships. And someone is drawn to all three things. And, of course, over it all, and I know I can safely say this to a good Pentecostal, is what we would call dunamis,
right.
Something Aristotle never knew about, the power of the Spirit.
Yeah.
But the Spirit works through a little bit of intellect, a little bit of emotion, and I think a lot of integrity.
Mm. That's beautiful. John, this has been so good. Thank you so much for being part of this. And I know that this will encourage and probably also challenge a few people. And where can people go to read some of the stuff that you have brought out? Like, where would you?
You could just go to undeceptions.com.
Undeceptions.com.
That's obviously the podcast, but it's also got links to everything I've done.
Great. Fantastic. Well, I hope that people go there, and I hope that we continue to equip ourselves, not only for our own faith, but also, as you say, to give reason for why we believe what we believe with kindness.
Yeah.
With kindness, yeah. Which is something that is a massive lack of these days. So thank you so much. God bless you.
Bless you, mate.
And looking forward to hearing about the Vikings.
All right.
All right. Thank you for listening to This Is Us podcast. Whether you listen to them as an individual or as a team, we hope that they add value to you. Make sure to click follow or subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. Thank you for joining us. We are who we are. This is us.